Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the unofficial start of the first post-Mardi Gras weekend here in the Crescent City. Yes, friends, here at NOLA Drinks. If you know of a lawyer that'll help clean up our mess and pay for it out of their own pocket, we want to know. Send them our way. Hey, friends, we got a good show for you here today, and happy to be talking to you post-Mardi Gras. Hope everyone had a great, great carnival. You can probably hear it in my voice. Well, it was too good. It was too good. All the predictions of doom and gloom with the bad weather didn't turn out too bad. We got a little bit of rain. We were talking about probably having to dodge some rain, but it wasn't anywhere near as bad as we may have feared. Beautiful days, really. So it was fantastic. Had a great carnival. As always, wonderful to see the parades, the marching groups, see a lot of your friends, good food, good drink, good just lively spirit, happy, happy, joy, joy. And now what does that mean? Yeah, it's festival season here in New Orleans because here we go. Yeah, we just start to just march right on through. So it's coming. And of course, as you stick with us here at NOLA Drinks, we'll talk all kinds of stuff about festivals and food and drink and blah, 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 because that's exactly what we do here on this show. But let me tell you a little bit about today's show, what we got going on in the second half-ish, if you will. Good friend of ours, Murph Reeves, who is a DJ on WWOZ 90.7 FM here in New Orleans. Great music station. If you want to be connected to New Orleans music, that's what station you need to listen to. And Murph is also a well-versed and experienced man in the restaurant business, the bar business, and he's doing some interesting things. So he knows his music, he knows his drink, he knows his food, he knows both sides of these businesses, and he's starting to do a really interesting thing on curating playlists for events and venues and these things. And, you know, it's one of those things where it may sound kind of weird. You know, I said this last week, why can't bartenders just play the music off the iPad kind of thing? But one of the things that we know here in New Orleans is that flavor notes and music notes, you know, tones, these things, whether you really realize it or not, they go together. It sets the mood. And one of the things you'll know, as Murph points out, if the music's bad, you'll know. If the music's good, you may not even notice, and that's the goal. So we talk about all kinds of things with Murph. But we're going to talk about now, coming up here for the next little bit, is, we're finished with Mardi Gras, right? So what does that mean? Curative, restorative, apothecary-type stuff, like drinks. Yeah, because that's what we talk about here on the show, friends. And, you know, it's funny, when I was starting to kind of pull different notes together and things like that, and certain articles that I was reading and different stuff like that, a lot of talk about these things taking place. You know, a lot of these articles came out right after the first of the year. And that's after everybody gets through the holidays. That's in January and such when they're looking to do the restorative thing. Well, here in New Orleans, we're a little different because the holidays, if you want to kind of argue semantics maybe, but whatever, the holidays go all the way through Mardi Gras and we just finished. So this is the time that I know I need some restorative action because, well, there you go. It was Mardi Gras. So that's what we're going to talk a little bit about today. A lot of interesting stuff there. Of course, New Orleans has a great connection, really kind of a bridge from going from these apothecary considerations to bars or cocktails, if you will. And a lot of that concept of restorative or curative, this is all really where this comes from, and it really transcends through that process as we move from apothecary to bar. And we'll get into that in a second. But we're mostly going to focus on drinks. Hey, if you're looking for some good food, Yakamain, we'll do another show on that down the road. Hey, I had a pile of fried chicken yesterday, so I'm just telling you, that made me feel pretty good. Different things you can do, of course, that way you can cleanse. You don't need to even drink alcohol if you don't want to. But this is a show about exploring the world of drinking food in New Orleans and beyond, so we're going to talk about drinks. So, of course, one of the things that we probably know and can imagine if we don't already know is that the idea of using herbs, spices, fruits, vegetables, seeds, roots, flowers, all kinds of botanicals for their curative properties, or what were thought to be their curative properties. Now, I think in many of these cases, there, as we know, traditional medicine has a great deal of value. Not going to debate that here, but that goes back centuries, really millennia for certain. So using that kind of stuff has a long history of treating ailments, whatever ails you, right? And we kind of move forward a little bit, and we start using these things and macerating them in alcohol, usually a high proof alcohol. And this was generally to preserve these things. And also, you know, they draw out a lot of the botanical stuff. They draw out a lot of the chemical compounds in these herbs and spices and fruits and so on and so forth in small doses. So that dates back a really long time as well. Now, these things were often used or dispensed to treat any number of things, digestive ailments, maybe headaches, respiratory issues. Of course, some considerations talking about long life, purging remedies, you know, things like fennel. It's a known laxative, rhubarb, laxative, just a good digestive aid, aniseed and star anise, another one of those that has long traditions in both Chinese and Western medicine. Teas have always been used to deliver these things, if you will. And what started to develop then over time were complex preparations of maceration, different combinations of these different botanicals and such, and then a distillation process to put these things together. And that's really where we arrive at patent medicine. Now, we sort of get into a mode of understanding what patent medicine is here in the conversation, and we'll get into this in just a second. But, you know, it was really kind of all over the board what that meant. We start to get into the idea of the cocktail. Now, originally, and we've talked about this on the show before, we're not going to go too far into the history of the cocktail and where the debate really about where the term comes from and when it was first applied to drinks and such. There is some people think that cocktails were invented in the United States, and that's really not the case. It's almost overwhelmingly proved that it probably started in Britain. There was an original mentioning in an 1806 paper here in the States. It was really connected to an election event where people were serving a quote-unquote cocktail to get people in the door, maybe kind of sully their mind a little bit and get them to vote for the candidate. But there's terms that go back, cocktail relating to horses and other things. We've done shows on that. We'll do more on that. But the definition of cocktail evolved to be the use of bitters, sugar, a stimulating alcohol. So that's going to be some of your hard spirit and water. Okay, now the author David Wondrich, a real great resource of all kinds of things, author of the book Imbibe, author of the book Punch, thinks that really kind of cocktails go back to at least the early 1700s in England. And again, these are and considered curative things, right? People, you would go to an apothecary and you would maybe get a nip before work. And, you know, this stuff, again, is steeped in alcohol. But that was the reason. Okay, now we all know what booze does, and everybody was drinking booze back then too. So maybe it's sort of like the pill popping days that we have now. Hey, my excuse is before work, I need to feel better, so I'm going to go have a little nip of something. But he cites the idea that, for example, Stoughton bitters, which were patented in 1712 in England, were very popular by that time in the early 18th century. It was marketed as a cure for hangovers, and it was generally mixed with canary wine, which is wine from the Canary Islands, a sweet wine, a fortified wine, very popular going back to the 16th and 17th centuries. As a matter of fact, it was mentioned in Twelfth Night by Shakespeare, but as I said, marketed as a hangover cure. And even by 1750, as Wondrich points out, it was mixed with brandy, as I said, but then sugar, the brandy was lit on fire, and then sugar was added and the sugar was melted. So we can kind of think that, you know, cocktails go back quite a bit earlier than the beginning of the 19th century. Now, here in New Orleans, friends, as I mentioned, we have a great connection to all of this. Louis Dufilo was the first licensed pharmacist in the U.S. But interestingly enough, what was going on, this was 1816 when he became the first licensed pharmacist. In 1804, the state of Louisiana passed a law that required a licensing exam for pharmacists that wanted to practice their craft. So prior to this time, this was before Louisiana was a state, there were some, you know, territorial measures and, you know, local stuff, but none was really enforced. A person could apprentice for a few months, and then they could compound and sell their own concoctions, really, without any regulation, standard monitoring, anything like that. So the public started, you know, people got all kinds of stuff. You could get really anything, wrong doses, wrong things, probably things that were maybe even toxic, who knows. But in 1804, as I said, this board was established through the law, and it was designed to identify, if you will, or license reputable pharmacists and physicians. And they had to take a 3-hour oral examination. It was actually given at the Cabildo right there in Jackson Square. Now, one can imagine, obviously, what was going on, that in these apothecaries, and what a lot of these people were doing, were making these compounds that I was talking about before, right? Taking these botanicals and all these other things, steeping them in alcohol, and then serving them or selling them, administering them in doses. They weren't cocktail glasses, they were in doses, and serving them as curative stuff. So we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about that. We're going to keep going here on Apothecary Cocktails, friends, and we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. Come on back.
I got to have it. I got to have it.
Wine, wine, wine.
I got to have it.
Wine, wine, wine.
Yes, I love it.
Wine, wine, wine.
I I like to drink it.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our Happier Hour menu.
Sobu's Happier Hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Baggio heads up the Small Plates and Charcuterie Kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
All right, everybody, Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome back to the show, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, we're talking about restorative and apothecary beverages here in a post-Mardi Gras world. We left off talking a little bit about bitters, and basically what we're getting at here is the idea of bitters have been around for a long, long time. People taking botanicals and other elements and macerating them, steeping them in high-proof alcohol, and then using these to deliver in small doses. These are being sold over-the-counter. I don't want to say home remedies because people were making them in their apothecaries and then eventually pharmacies to sell to people, but they were marketed and sold as curatives. Bitters were all over the place. People were making them everywhere in their own little concoctions of bitters at their own stores and even in their own homes. But in the case of commercial ventures, small and large, as we start to get to, they were always marketed and sold and presented as a curative, okay, because of their herbal properties, their restorative properties, curative properties, herbal medicine. We've talked about that. Prohibition hit and only three survived. We're going to skip ahead just briefly because we're going to highlight a couple of these brands that you know. Fee Brothers was one, and Fee Brothers during Prohibition here in the United States was down to only making a few gallons, but then made a comeback. That's a story for another show. But the other two that we're going to talk about are Peychaud's and Angostura, because these are really the first two to build a brand, if you will, and be asked for by name outside of their own storefront, if you will. So, Jenna, we'll start with Peychaud's because we're really basing that here. It comes from New Orleans, where we are. A gentleman named Amadie Peychaud, who is a Creole immigrant from San Domingo, which is now Haiti. He was a pharmacist, and he had a family recipe for bitters, basically. And he, by 1838, he had an establishment, his own pharmacy, on 437 Royal Street. What he started doing, Mr. Amadie Peychaud, is taking cognac, which was commonly available here in New Orleans due to the connection with France, of course, imported from there. And he was basically taking cognac and spicing it with his own bitters in a very small portion in a jigger or using a small glass called a coquettier. Some people have theorized that maybe people were sort of slurring the word coquettier and merging that with the word cocktail. Now, we've already talked about how cocktail was defined and used before this time. 1838 we're talking about, but maybe that's how there was some confusion or how this the worlds melded, if you will. Not a whole lot of evidence for that, but I guess it's possible. The interesting thing here is Peychaud's built a name, and people started asking for this bitters in other establishments around New Orleans and then beyond. In 1850, the Sazerac Coffee House was open, and coffee houses was the term what we would call, in many cases, bars today. We didn't call them bars then. We called them coffee houses. So I was located there on Exchange Alley, also in the French Quarter. And in 1850, the owner, Sewell Taylor, was using Sazerac de Fauges et Fil Cognac, a brand of cognac that he imported exclusively from France, and hence the name of the coffee house, Sazerac Coffee House. And he was using Peychaud's bitters, blending that with the cognac, hence the birth of the famous cocktail, the Sazerac. Now, this is probably by the time we get to 1850, where we start to you know, blend, we move further down that continuum of going from apothecary to pharmacy to what we would call bar. Okay. Again, sort of foggy. It's all really a continuum. And in a certain sense, yeah, we'd like to know these things, but there's no real pinpoint, as I said before. It's just, it's a continuum. I'm going to use that word. There we go. In 1869, a gentleman named Thomas Handy bought the coffee house, and in 1873, he bought the rights to pay shows. And even to this day, the Sazerac Company, who maintains a portfolio here, they continue to make and sell pay shows bitters, and it's sold really all over the world. Now, the other one that we all know and love is Angostura Bitters, certainly the largest brand of bitters in the world, and there's really no debate about that. A German doctor who studied at the University of Berlin actually served in Waterloo on the German side there in the battle. His name is Johann Gottlieb Benjamin Siegert. He was the founder of Angostura Bitters. What this guy did, he was an adventurous guy. So after serving there at Waterloo, he actually moved to Venezuela and eventually found his way to being the Surgeon General for Field Marshal Simon Bolivar, and he was based in the town of Angostura, which is now actually Ciudad Bolivar. And he had, a, you know, as a physician, he had a botanical knowledge, and he started gathering stuff from the local area there in Venezuela. And by 1824, he had perfected a blend of bitters. Strangely enough, what some people think, and it's a secret, you know, still like many of these things are, what the actual recipe is. There is no Angostura bark in Angostura bitters. It's named after the town. Okay, so there you go. Just a little fun fact for you. The whole idea was he was making these bitters to keep troops on their feet, if you will. It was a bit of a stimulant, maybe made them feel better when they had malaria, aid in digestive distress. Since Ciudad Bolivar, or what was called Angostura then, which actually means the Narrows in Spanish, it was a trading post on the Orinoco River. And so this stuff started to spread down the river and was making its way. It was in nearby Trinidad, for example, which makes sense, and started to be traded in the area. And even by the 1830s, it was found in England. The word began to spread, and people were asking for Angostura bitters. During that time, even, it was thought to aid in seasickness. Siegert was a really good marketer. He started showing the bitters at World Expos and traveling and promoting the brand. His sons became involved in the brand. He died in 1870, and due to some political strife in Venezuela, they moved the company actually to Trinidad, where it is still there today. And actually something like only five people know the recipe. So those are our two big brands. And again, you see the histories of these brands of bitters. They're marketed as curative. They're marketed as medicines. But we, as we talked about with the Sazerac Coffee House in 1850, we see it in a drink. So this is where we kind of start to merge this world of stuff. Now we're going to talk a little bit about liqueurs. One of the things I want to talk about is potable and non-potable bitters. Okay. Potable bitters, the idea, that's what we're really talking about. Bittering liqueurs is what I would call them. So we're talking about, say, something like absinthe, Benedictine, Fernet Branca, Genipese, Chartreuse. They're called potable. They tend to be maybe a little bit lower in proof, and they're generally served in ounces. Now, when we talk about cocktail bitters, that's the term, things like Peychaud's and Angostura, they're, believe it or not, called non-potable bitters, and those are served in dashes, small amounts. The reason why they're called non-potable bitters is, at least in the eyes of the regulatory world, you're not going to go drink a whole glass of Peychaud's bitters or Angostura bitters or shots. Now, I do. There's a famous drink called the Trinidad Sour. Look it up. One of my favorite drinks. The base is Angostura Bitters. There's another drink I'll tell you to go get. Go to Barrel Proof, Lower Garden District. Ask for the Bucket of Blood. Owner Liam has to be there. It's not in the book. Story for another time. Also, Angostura and Peychaud Bitters base. But the idea is that these were, they're small, they're high in alcohol, they're very, very bitter. So the idea are bitter and mixed with other flavors, but maybe too bitter to drink. Again, I kind of disagree with that. But from a regulatory standpoint, that's why these things are often sold outside of liquor stores, and they're not regulated as liquor. Okay, so those are the difference. Cocktail bitters, things like Peychaud's and Angostura, and also then potable bitters, bittering liqueurs, Amari, Benedictine, Fernet, Chartreuse, so on and so forth. So of course, these have a very interesting history as well. And they're all over the place. We're not going to get into the specific histories of different things, but the same idea applies, that these different beverages, and a lot of these really just, you know, go back a few centuries. So these different, liqueurs, if you will, were also marketed for their curative properties. And maybe it even ranged from just a pleasant after-dinner drink to settle your stomach, so in part curative and in part pleasurable. But things like chartreuse, for example, made by monks, was created in 1737, made by Carthusian monks. That was actually based on a 1605 manuscript, contained something like, the original one anyway, 130 botanicals. It's a secret. Only two monks, I believe, actually know how to make it and what the blend is. And that does go back to being, was marketed as a medicine, okay? Absinthe, for example, contains wormwood using its leaves and blossoms that's known to help with digestion and other considerations. And even things like vermouth, for example, fortified wine, was made with wormwood as well, or often in, you know, had wormwood as one of its ingredients. And vermouth was marketed and said to detox or even alleviate or prevent food poisoning. You have other fortified wine-based stuff like beer, which is a quinine-based, or has quinine in it, I should say, and that's also been considered a digestif. So, you know, a lot of these different things, again, have this sort of blending, if you will, of cocktail ingredients, sort of continue to transcend, but always had their foot in the world of curative powers. Brandy was another one, not a bittering agent, but it was thought to be a laxative and a purgative, and it was even used to treat heroin addicts after they were given a water and vinegar cleanse. So you have all these different spirits, and where I'm going with this here, and we'll talk about this just after the break, is that a lot of the cocktails that we know as curative cocktails contain some of these different ingredients or different liqueurs in them because of that history and because of that connection. So this is when we're going to talk about moving from pharmacy to bar. Friends, are going to take a little break here on the show. Come on back.
The French Market is a place where history is made fresh daily. From the historic Upper Pontalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving Farmers Market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market. Making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. It's football and festival season, and there's no better way to enjoy Sazerac Rye than in a pothole cocktail. Just fill up a glass with ice and your favorite root beer, and add 2 ounces of Sazerac Rye for a truly tasty toddy. Named after the city's most iconic of inconveniences, the pothole is proof that New Orleans never takes itself too seriously. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranac's, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Good
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans or in podcast land, wherever you may be. Friends, thanks for tuning in. Hey, whether you are recovering from celebrating Mardi Gras here in the New Orleans area or anywhere the carnival was celebrated, you're just with us in spirit, anything like that, my well wishes are going out to you right now. I know I need some. That's a little bit about what we're talking about here today, apothecary cocktails and drinks, and some of the history connected to how we go all the way back to herbal medicines, dating back millennia through what came to be known as patent medicines, apothecaries, the earliest pharmacies, and how many of these botanical ingredients were being used and then steeped in alcohol, which really led to the rise of what we call bitters and also then potable bitters, liqueurs, and other stuff similar to that. And how that transcends or transforms, I should say, from a curative consideration, an apothecary consideration, to a cocktail enjoyed for, you know, basically for pure enjoyment. That was redundant, but I'm saying that anyway. So really by the late 19th century, we are in the so-called golden age of cocktails. And the point that I made that I think we've gathered here today is that it's a continuum, right? These things started out as being marketed as curative. They obviously have properties of enjoyment that we enjoy now today in the modern world of cocktails. And that really, that whole transition seemed to really take place by and large in the 19th century. Now, certainly we can talk about alcohol being enjoyed way before that. You know, people drinking rum. I mean, the history of beer goes back thousands of years. Wine, that sort of thing. We're really talking about cocktails and apothecary cocktails and those roots and how those things came together. Now we talk about, say, wine, fortified wine, vermouths as a really good example, beer, which is B-Y-R-R-H, that blends a Mistel and quinine, was marketed as a health drink, for example. Also, so we see sort of the merging of things like wine with stuff that was sold as a curative or restorative. Certainly when we talk about some modern cocktails that we might enjoy have curative roots, like the Sazerac cocktail. A couple notes there, too, that I wanted to say. You know, one is that, as I keep talking about, it's sort of this continuum. Maybe we look at 1850 as a certain watershed moment where we start to see more of a delineation between the curative to the enjoyed casual social cocktail. Hard to say, but we can look at that. It's certainly a landmark or a milestone in this process. One thing I wanted to mention too is that, you know, to clarify, there's some debate about the Sazerac cocktail as far as, you know, exactly what it was when, but for the most part, 1850, like we talked about at the Sazerac Coffee House there in Exchange Alley, that was a mix of Peychaud's, bitters, and cognac. And by 1873, the recipe was tweaked a little bit, and that was when it was altered to replace the French brandy or cognac with American rye whiskey, because American rye whiskey was a lot easier to get a hold of by that time. And then that's also right around that time when the dash of absinthe was added. Now, one of the things that I think we're seeing here is a lot of these original cocktails then, in the truest sense of cocktail, are using ingredients that have curative past. So things like chartreuse, absinthe, this stuff, they would go back, you know, a few centuries at the least for their recipes, and they were marketed or made as curatives. So when we move through this continually, move into the modern age of cocktails now, and then certainly from the period of the golden age of cocktails in the late 19th century to the renaissance of cocktails, rediscovering classic cocktails as we are now, really that started in the early 2000s. It's no surprise then that a lot of these ingredients that are used in these drinks are those that have roots in curative pasts. So there's the take-home lesson there. I wanted to mention making that transition as we were talking about going from apothecary to pharmacy to bar. We've talked about that a little bit, but another big step, at least here in the United States, and I think it had, you know, similar parallels in other countries, was the Pure Food and Drug Act was passed in 1906. And as we talked about, a lot of these patent medicines were not really monitored before. Yes, we touched on in the state of Louisiana in 1804 when there was the first licensing for pharmacists and physicians who were employing these things as curatives took place. But a lot of stuff was all over the map. You had snake oil salesmen and traveling road shows. You had people that were true pharmacists trying to practice true medicine and everything in between. So another attempt, a big attempt to regulate was the Pure Food and Drug Act. And basically, the long and the short of it is, if you couldn't prove that it had a medicinal value, and I think there's a lot of haziness in that too, that you couldn't sell it in under certain guises. And that really effectively was probably the biggest moment in pushing this stuff out of apothecaries and exclusively into the realm of bars. And then certainly prohibition comes and stuff like that. That's topics for other shows. But that was really kind of how we moved from apothecary to pharmacy to bar. Obviously, there's different trajectories that are overlapping in different ways, as we've discussed. But as we get back to talking about how some of these ingredients then are used in classic cocktails, we look at, you know, as I was mentioning, the Sazerac cocktail, an absinthe rinse. We've talked about that. Wormwood, the leaves and the blossoms as a digestif. It uses Sazerac rye now, but used brandy before. And we talked about how brandy was used to treat heroin addicts. It was thought to be a laxative and a purgative. We talk about then the dashes of Peychaud's bitters, which we've covered as well pretty well, and talking about how that was invented as a curative by Amédée Peychaud here in New Orleans. The Vieux-Carré cocktail, here's another great example. Classic cocktail invented here in New Orleans, actually in the early 20th century at the Hotel Monteleon. But let's look at the ingredients, okay? The ingredients of that cocktail, rye whiskey, cognac, sweet vermouth, Peychaud's bitters, Angostura bitters, and Benedictine. There's a potable bitter for you. All of those, for the most part, have some connection to being seen at least as curatives. Maybe not so much the rye whiskey, but everybody thought, hey, having a little nip of that makes you feel better. But certainly, as we talked about the cognac brandy thing, vermouth, we've talked about that, and then the bitters and the Benedictine. So we're seeing a lot of these classic cocktails have these ingredients, chartreuse, absinthe. We won't go, well, these are all topics for other shows, getting a little further into that. You know, friends, if you're just looking for a little restorative and you're trying to keep it easy, you can do something really simple. Just take a little bit of fizzy water, like a club soda, and add 4 or 5 dashes of your favorite bitters, Peychaud's, Angostura, Fee Brothers, whatever it is that you want, and that'll make you feel better. Go out and get yourself a Bloody Mary. That can make you feel better. But I find it really, really interesting. A lot of these classic cocktails that we're drinking now, and many of them that are advertised as apothecary cocktails, do indeed have their roots to ingredients that were sold as curatives. It's fascinating history here, friends. We'll get into more of this stuff as we move forward here with the NOLA Drink Show, without a doubt. We could talk for hours about many of these different, the potable and non-potable bitters, the history of some of these cocktails, the history of the term cocktail. It's all very interesting history. Wanted to give a quick shout out here to a couple of the resources that you may want to check out and some stuff that I've cited here today. Apothecary Cocktails, Restorative Drinks from Yesterday and Today. Warren Bobro, really cool book there. It's got a really interesting history interspersed with some great cocktail recipes. Really cool book to check out. That's kind of my favorite. Another one, A Spirited History of a Classic Cure-All called Bitters by Brad Thomas Parsons. Really interesting there as well. You can certainly visit the New Orleans Pharmacy Museum on 437 Royal Street. A lot of stuff to be mined there. So check a lot of that stuff out if you're interested. Those are two of my recommendations for things to explore. And go check out some of the interesting histories of some of these liqueurs that we're talking about. Chartreuse, very, very fascinating how it relates to the monks. The monks were expelled to Spain, came back, were allowed to make it again. Absinthe obviously has an interesting history. And so, that's some interesting stuff there. I'm going to leave it at that. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the show, and we're going to come back and chat with our good buddy Murph Reeves. We're going to talk about music. We're going to talk about drinks. We're going to talk about pairing music and drinks and playlists and fun and all kinds of stuff. Then we'll be back to close out the show. Thanks for tuning in today. As always, friends, we're going to take a little break here on the show. Come on back.
Hey ladies, are you looking for wine to bring to your next girl's night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley. California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning in, as always, friends. And if you're listening to this now, we've all survived Mardi Gras. This may be a posthumous recording on my part, can't promise anything, but I am pleased to be sitting here at Angeline Restaurant, a super fine place that you need to check out on Charter Street. And we are sitting here with my good friend, Murph Reeves. Murph, good to see you, buddy.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going great, man. It's good to have you on the show. It's the first time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm pretty excited to be here. I'm a guest. Usually, I'm the guy talking, asking the questions.
Yeah.
And this time, I'll be giving some answers, hopefully.
Well, let's tee that up, man, because it's always a role reversal thing, which I totally appreciate. And in this situation, so you're doing the sting. You do the Louisiana Music Show Mondays from 11 to 2 on the super awesome best station in the universe, WWOZ.
Man. Yes, it's a New Orleans Music Show, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on WWOZ. 90.7 FM or WWOZ.org. They do New Orleans Music Show Monday through Friday. I got the Monday slot.
Yeah, and it's great, man. I love that slot because all five of you that do that slot different every day. And well, then I guess, you know, Black Mold and Bill mix it up on Fridays. So six of y'all that do that slot. And I always say this. So I'm on this particular AM radio station, which is like UHF, but we're still around, that... Man, you need to listen to OZ. If you want to connect to New Orleans, I don't listen to my own radio station. I just listen to OZ, man.
Thank you. OZ is kind of like, it was like a school for me about New Orleans music. I wanted to be in radio since I was started college, and then life took me in its own direction. I moved down here in 2001, and I think the second day I was here, I walked into OZ and was like, how do I get on the air? What do
no
I have
way.
To do?
No, no way. I didn't know that. So
that was it. I said, how do I get on the air? They said, oh, you got to volunteer and you go through this training courses. And this is back in 2001. It's a lot more different now. So my training was we read over a packet about, you know, FCC rules. And then I sat in with a bunch of the hosts and just watched them. And they're like, okay. You're trained.
And here, did you start like filling in for people?
Yeah.
Backing up?
My first show was at 3 a.m. And this was back when WWOZ was in Armstrong Park.
Yeah.
Back in 2001.
In the treehouse, yeah.
Yeah. So you didn't go in Armstrong Park after dark. You know, all I heard was there was like crazies and like aliens and zombies, like the most crazy kind of crackhead imaginable. So what they also didn't tell you was at 5 o'clock, they put a chain in front of the driveway that goes into the treehouse.
At 5 p.m.?
Yeah.
Okay.
So at 2:30 in the morning when I pull up, I'm like scratching my head. How do I get in here? So I end up having to go in through Basin Street, through the Mahalia Jackson parking lot.
Oh, yeah.
And just kind of kept on driving around until the only way to keep going was to drive on the sidewalk. And so I was like, well, okay.
That was not in the packet then.
No, there was nothing about that in the packet. I ended up driving on the lip of the fountain to get around and parked. I got out. I had CDs. That was the thing at the time. So I had like three books of CDs. I'm holding them, and there's a door. It's locked, and there's a red light bulb. So if the red light bulb's on, the DJ's on air. So I'm just standing outside, like, waiting for the zombies to come out and, like, eat my face. And I'm like, please, please, red light. I'm just looking at it, like, red light. Like, and then I got in, and four walls, floor to ceiling of records.
Yeah.
And I just sat in there, and the guy's like, all right, see you later. And then I was a little nervous, and I made a couple mistakes. But then once I kind of got it, I was like, I'm playing music on the air for probably four people, but so what? Like, three of those four might be paying attention. One guy's he's probably really high.
Yeah, asleep or laying on the couch. Yeah, no doubt.
Or my parents might be listening. And then that was it. And I started learning about New Orleans music. I knew some from where I grew up in Pennsylvania. That was one of the reasons why I came down here. You know, I discovered Professor Longhair in like sixth grade. I discovered everything through the Grateful Dead because, you know, they're like one of the greatest cover bands of all time.
You and me both.
And when they would do Ico, Ico, there was something different about that song than all the other songs. The rhythm was different. And I would hear the Dixie Cups on Easy Listening Radio going to the chapel or their version of Ico, Ico. And I'm like, why is that song stand out? And then when I made the connection between the Grateful Dead and Dr. John, and because they just kind of hung in the same circles. And then I heard the words Giacomo Finanè. I'm like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And with everyone singing it. And then I heard Professor Longhair and I was like, well, Dr. John, Professor Longhair. And then the Meters. I was like, what's up with New Orleans? Like, why is this different? And everyone seems to be drawn there. And that was one of the reasons why I came down. And, you know, I started playing music on the air, and then I would read about them. All right, what are they listening to? And what are they listening to? And who is this? And who is this? And it was just, it's like you start scratching at something, and it's like all of a sudden you're picking like at a picture, then you pick behind it, and there's this even more beautiful picture.
It gets deeper.
And then it's getting bigger.
It's like
deeper.
An archaeological dig, right? Yeah. Keep going, keep going. You know, man, you were mentioning this too, and just off on a tangent, but growing up in the Bay Area, I grew up listening to the Dead. And one of my very favorite quotes that made sense to me, you're talking about Ico Ico, it was an interview with Bob Weir. And Bob was talking about how, you know, some of the best nights when the Dead were on, and forgive me for those of you who don't know a ton about music, but talking about playing on the one, the first beat in the measure. And that, you know, beat that sets up the measure and sets up the song. And he was talking about the nights that we're on, the one, and I'm paraphrasing, the one is apparent, the one is manifest, and nobody's playing right on the one. Somebody's right in front, somebody's right behind, and with New Orleans music, playing with that syncopation, playing just behind the beat, that lilting kind of thing. That's it, huh? In a lot of ways.
It's kind of behind the beat. Stanton Moore said it best, I think, of Stanton Moore. He says it's like New Orleans rhythm is like a clave rhythm, but it's lazy.
Hurry up and slow down.
Like every once in a while, they leave out a beat. They're just like, no.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden when you feel it, it's like that beat that almost it tugs you and pulls you. And it's like almost a reflex. Like when I start dancing and when I get really into these second line dances, like I feel it in my shoulders and like in my clavicle. Like that's where I feel the music pulling me. And it is that syncopated, like that little chop of a rhythm that's like, it almost makes you want to step. Like you got to jump up over a speed bump.
Yeah.
But you do it in a super groovy way.
And different musicians are playing on different aspects of the beat. So the beat, it's like a road map, but nobody's following the map exactly.
They haven't memorized, so they can go off.
Yeah.
But they know exactly where the main path is that we're all still following.
Yeah, exactly.
We're
going
to go around here. And we're going to show you these really beautiful flowers sonically, and then we'll come back. This way you'll get a bigger picture of what the song means because we went this way with it or that way. And, you know, I mean, look at Mardi Gras. You know, we hear Mardi Gras in New Orleans or going to the Mardi Gras 1,000 different ways. And they're all, there's still a new one coming out, a new band or a new version. They're like, oh, that's really good.
And new read on the set. Yeah. No doubt, man. You know, one of the things that you do too, Murph, that I really appreciate whenever you, and I've said this to you before, you always turn up really cool versions of songs that I know that I've not heard before, that particular version. I think that's a really neat thing you do on the show, man.
It's a way to keep on being connected to the song because the songs, like Alan Toussaint's songs are really good like that. They're just amazing. And then you hear somebody else do them and you realize how amazing they are because you can hear everything that Alan did and then all these other people are like, well, we don't really need to do anything, but we're just going to put on this flashy shirt because we can. Like, I just saw Liz Wright perform at the Mahalia Jackson for, it was Truth, Racial Harmony, and Transformation. They had a big day, all different cities had different performances, and we were one of them. And she does Southern Nights on her new album. It's all covers.
Oh, cool. Okay.
It's called Grace is the album. And it was a lot slower, bluesier. Her voice is like...
And that's already a lilting slow song, yeah, Alan's version.
But yeah, she just... She kind of made it her own, but you could tell, like, if he was a book, she was holding it in her hand and just kind of, like, looking at it and then ad-libbing a little bit, but it was always right there. Like, I swear he was in the room. Like, I feel like he's just here all the time, especially when there's, like, really good music happening. He's just, like... It's like New Orleans is kind of like his piano now. He just kind of, like... Not like a puppet master, but kind of.
For everybody that he played with, produced, wrote for, I think that makes a lot of sense, man.
You know, and then when you discover who played him, like, I still am, I got really into disco music, like Sister Sledge and Schick, but going past their hits, Lady Marmalade, that whole album by LaBelle was produced by Alan Toussaint, Then these group start doing his songs, and you hear this like different kind of funk because you got the disco and the like some of the electronics in there, and they keep on taking it.
It's amazing, dude. Hold that thought, because we're gonna come back and talk more about this. We're gonna take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show. Brian Deese here with you. Come on back.
For a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails, Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Night before last, I got loaded on a bottle of whiskey. On a bottle of whiskey. Night before last, I got loaded on a bottle of whiskey. On a bottle of whiskey. So I feel all right.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, Nola Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Deese.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Thanks for tuning in. We are chatting with my good friend Murph Reeves, talking about music. And as we do often on the show, when we're taping in advance, which we're doing, we take these breaks and then we start talking about all kinds of other things in the middle. But Murph, as I recall, man, we left off, we were talking about Alan Toussaint's music, and then we were talking about how you got into disco. And we're talking about Alan's involvement in that with Chic and
Sister Sledge.
Sister Sledge and Lady Marmalade, man. Yeah.
I think it's just because I'm still, I still have the thigh high boots mentality from Mardi Gras, that maybe it's like I'm still there with the disco. it's Mardi Gras is a magical time when thigh highs become, like normal attire, and King Cake becomes a food group for, whatever, a month or two.
It was just R&B on blow, kind of, right?
Yeah.
pretty
much. But yeah, it was the disco, I don't know, because it brought a freshness, but New Orleans already had that rhythm there, and like other people just capitalized on it, and it got out to other people in other parts of the country and other parts of the world, but I don't think anyone made a connection that it was New Orleans music, because they just thought it was Sister Sledge or Patti LaBelle.
Yeah.
It's only been, I would say in like the last 10 years that people outside of New Orleans really know who Alan Toussaint is, and probably since Katrina was when he started touring. He was really content to stay here and produce here and perform here.
Yeah.
But he didn't leave much. A lot of New Orleans musicians, they'd rather stay here. Like Kermit Ruffins, I mean, I think his perfect world is setting up his grill outside of his club where he can drink beer and smoke weed and cook food. And then if he feels like playing, play.
At like 7 o'clock. Dude doesn't even play at 11 o'clock at night anymore. You know,
he wants to play early, and you never know what he's going to play. And I don't know, that spontaneity, it's kind of magical.
Yeah, no doubt, man. When you're talking about we're talking about the well of music here and the influence that music from New Orleans has had, just even looking at 50s R&B music, it is remarkable the amount of music. So when you're talking about Patti LaBelle and these things and the influence of disco, the influence of Alan Toussaint, these things that have this reach that people may not know, it is so deep. And so even if you're listening to the podcast and you're not here from New Orleans, there is so much music that has touched your life that these people had at least an influence on, that and that cannot be overstated, actually.
Some would argue that the blues started here. I tend to agree with it. If not, like,
it's one of the centers.
Yeah. It seems more like a regional thing, but we're definitely in like the epicenter.
We're down the river from maybe where it started on that level,
But
Memphis.
It happened like if nothing else, all those people that were doing things met here.
Yep.
And communicated it here, and it all of a sudden maybe coagulated here.
Yep.
And same with rock and roll. I mean, you go to Matassa's grocery store, that name, like Cosmos, you go to the
laundromat now.
Coin slip or the coin spin.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, you walk in there. I used to do my laundry there because that was where Cosmo recorded Dave Bartholomew and Fats Domino and Lloyd Price and Paul Gayton and Ann Laurie and Barbara Lynn. And that was where he recorded them on one microphone. That with a piano that was the higher end keys were tuned up higher so you could hear it better on the record, and the horn player stood different distances away from the mic so everyone could get in and you could hear the sound, and that was what we sold to the world, and people were like, what is this? This is rock and roll.
Yep.
And that's what we did it with, like, I call it, you know, duct tape and prayers. Like, they just made it happen. And that's what this kind of city's like. It hasn't been given a lot. It's always had to make it, you know?
That's a good point, man.
It's like, it makes a lot about them. I mean, look at Mardi Gras Indians. They took, their culture was erased, but they were given a kind of a freedom here in New Orleans because of New Orleans. I'm not going to say a freedom, but like a kind of one. And then that was taken away, and then they were taken in by Native American cultures. So they built what they have out of something that they kind of remember, a good thing and another good thing. Like, they built a culture out of pieces of other cultures.
Right.
And now, like, it's a New Orleans treasure. I mean, it should be a national treasure, but I mean, those guys, when they walk the streets in their suits, they're telling stories and they're living all those stories that came before them. People, like, their suits are telling the stories of the people who live those things.
No doubt.
And then they put it to music and they make it funky. Like, I mean, with a tambourine, you're just like, this is amazing. This tambourine is like, all of a sudden the song is huge and it's one tambourine, but the way he's playing it is, it's tapping into like primal stuff.
Yeah, right, man. And you know what? When you think too, I mean, I'm always, and you're more knowledgeable by a long shot than I am on this. One of the things I'm always really interested in is going back and listening to, as we noted, we're taping this before Mardi Gras, but Mardi Gras, which just passed, as you folks are hearing this, going back and listening to try and find the earliest versions of what we might call recorded Mardi Gras music. And, you know, I look at people say, like, I mean, certainly Danny Barker, certainly Baby Dodds, right?
Yes.
And so when those street chants, I mean, I'm going to call them street chants, we can call them prayers, when those started to get put on wax and put on vinyl and recorded, and those intersections, this wasn't something that somebody went and said, hey, we're going to go do an Alan Lomax Smithsonian recording and go out and record these people in the field. I know a little bit of that happened, but the idea was this stuff started to find itself into the consciousness of recorded music because people like Cosmo Matassa and things like that were building studios and recording music in their neighborhoods, right?
That's what he was. It was a neighborhood spot. It was in the back of, I think, a barber shop.
Yeah.
It was almost kind of like a speakeasy, and it was a clique of musicians. It was like an inner group that, you know, it was like the, had to get in it somehow, But yeah, I mean, if you read interviews with Cosmo, he's like, he sort of fell into it. Like, his family was like, before, I think it was a jukebox business, and before it was something else, it just kind of went his way.
And people he knew and a space he had.
Yep. And then one thing led to another, and then he was making it up as he went. And then pretty soon what they had created was a sound based on what they had lying around, you know? So, and then they just kept on working on that sound. And all of a sudden, like, when it started going out and on the Billboard charts, and, you know, you're making a Fats Domino record, selling 100,000, 500,000.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They're like, well, let's just keep on doing it. I mean, Fats Domino never changed. He consciously said, I'm going to just be Fats Domino and play these songs the same way because I think people want to hear that. Mm-hmm. And he was right.
And he was absolutely right.
You know, his stuff, yeah. I mean, he just passed, and like the outpouring of emotion from this city. And just listen to the people who are influenced by him. You know, people like, I don't know, the Beatles or Robert Plant. Like, all these people, when they were kids, listen to this stuff and like, I want to do that.
Yes.
And, yes. You know, like, especially the Beatles, because then Fats Domino's recorded Beatles songs, you know, and that's...
That you can see how,
and we... That's another thing that's great about New Orleans music, and, you know, being on the air, I meet so many bands or members of bands that have moved here recently, and you can hear their sound is from somewhere else. And then I talk to them a year or two later, and all of them have horn sections.
Right.
And it's like New Orleans has just gotten into them somehow, and their sound has changed, and their outlook on music has changed. And they realize, you know, they're writing a song, but they need the group to like get the message out and get them, because the message should be big and full, hence the horn section.
Right.
You know, I almost sometimes I wish personally I had like my own personal horn section when I did cool things, or like, you know, all of a sudden there's these little horns behind. Like, oh, I remember something good. Yeah, the saxophone just turned in.
You killed it at the gas station, man.
Or when I screw up, like, wah, wah, wah.
Right. Well, you know, and I don't want to go too far down this road, Murph, because 2 weeks ago, a good mutual friend of ours, Mark Stone, fine local musician, and Mark and I have been friends for a number of years, as I know you have with him as well. And we talk about, you know, people that come here from somewhere else to play music on the street. Actually, when I was just walking to meet you here at Angeline, walking by a kid, you know, walking down Decatur, and, you know, just sitting in a doorway in Decatur, and we always know that can be kind of hit or miss. This kid was slinging some serious bluegrass and could actually finger pick. And, you know, that catches your ear when some of these kids that are sitting on the street are playing, because sometimes it's just they're hacking around or, you know, whatever. They came by a secondhand, third-hand guitar.
Right.
But then, like, this kid was picking. He was picking and grinning, man. And I stopped for a second. I'm like, yeah. And you get these moments, and, like, Mark, we know as a mutual friend, moved from New York, playing on the street, standing out in front of what was Margaritaville, where B.B. King's is now, and caught the attention of Eddie Bo. And that process of going through this, where we have a process here where you come, you play music, and then if somebody finds you, they take you under your wing. There's a trajectory that can go from the street to recording.
Yes.
Well, do me a favor, man. I'm sorry, because I'm waxing philosophical. Let me take another break, man.
Sure.
We're come on back. We're going to talk a little bit more about all kinds of stuff with Murph. Come on back.
Till you spit on my morning. No use for you to cry. I see you by and by. Cause I'm walking to New Orleans.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today. Miro Cellars.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, we're here at Angeline Restaurant on Chartres Street. In the lower French Quarter, chatting with Murph Reeves. And Murph, we've done what we've done again, man. So we did about a 9.5 minute segment, and then you and I have been chatting for about the past 45 minutes, which is always interesting, my friend. Happy to sit here with you, man.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's just, you know, New Orleans is so great. One story just leads to another, and everything is so interconnected here that you can't talk about one thing without it sort of spilling over into other things.
Into other things. Yeah, we even got onto thermal vents and life living on the ocean floor at 8,000 feet. But man, we were talking about New Orleans music before we went on the break. And one of the things that you have an interesting mix of experience. We've talked about how, you know, you're a DJ at WWOZ. We didn't really talk about you're running the beverage program here at Angeline. You got a lot of experience in the hospitality and restaurant industry. You have a firm understanding of the aesthetic and running a room. And a huge part of that, you've married these worlds of bringing music into the hospitality thing, man. I think it's really cool what you're doing.
Well, it's just, the restaurant experience is very sensory. And one of them, you know, hearing is one of those things. It's like when you're in the kitchen, you hear something sizzle or you hear the bartender shaking ice. Like, there's a sound that goes along with what we're doing. And the music's there. And it's also another way to enhance the experience if you put some thought into it. You know, most people don't really notice the music unless it's bad.
Right.
And then when it's bad or it doesn't fit, it's like it's the only thing you can notice in the room. I mean, I've left restaurants because I'm like, this isn't right for me. My ramen doesn't taste good with rave music at 2 in the afternoon. All of those things are awesome things, but together at this moment, they're not.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we were talking about how, you know, the restaurant industry is changing and it's getting hard for some restaurants, you know, let's just call them mom and pops that don't have a giant machine behind them. It just has, you know, passion and integrity and your skills. So how do you stand out DIYing it with using no money? You know, you have to, what do you have that you already have here? You have your walls, you have your lights, you have your music. And once you start researching music and, you know, there's a lot of similarities between music and food, and especially in other cultures.
Yep.
Like, there's certain tones that go with certain flavors, you know, in Japanese culture, in Indian culture. There's even a psychologist, I think his proper title is psychologist, Charles Spence out of Britain. He's been, and my girlfriend has worked with him. That's how I got turned on to him. But he has certain tones that go with certain flavors. Sweet has a certain tone. Sour has a certain tone. You know, and I started thinking of Pythagoras, the mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first guy to use music as a healing force.
Mm-hmm.
He was also the first guy to identify a perfect fifth, you know, the 3, 1, 3, and a 5.
Yep.
So those three notes individually sound pretty cool, but when you play them together, they sound amazing. It's just like when you make a sauce, you put all these ingredients together and you're like, well, these all taste like this, but together it tastes like something that nobody's ever tasted before and doesn't want to stop.
Yeah, and you know, man, I really appreciate you saying that, because one of the things that I am a big fan of is talking about this is that there are very few things in this world that you can break it down to the rational. So music is, you can, you know, like you're talking about the 1-3-5, or, you know, the 1-4-5 is a good example, the intervals. You can break that down into sine waves and cosine waves and megahertz, and it's mathematically beautiful. Those curves,
yes,
are perfect, and there's a reason why that makes sense. And the same thing with when you make wine, when you make food, you know, I can break these down into its physical or chemical components. That's the rational part. The irrational part is also required. And there are a small number of things in life that the rational and the irrational have to come together to work to make them that ephemeral,
the sublime
experience that they are.
Yeah.
And there are very few things. Music is one of them. Food is one of them. Drink is one of them. Few others, art.
Yeah, I go back to the Pythagoras thing. So what, yeah, I'm trying to make is a flavor chord.
Beautiful.
So like an interval, a food interval, a drink interval, and a music interval, and light, or like the way the silverware feels. Like everything can become important, and if you take the time to learn about it, everything can become an art form if you want to put the time into it. And do you have the time? You know, time is money, but music, we all have it. We all play it. You go into almost any place, it's played somewhere.
Right.
So how do you tap into that? Me here, you know, like we'll pair songs with food, and we'll, whether it's in a historical context or a geographical context, or I don't know, some things just sound right when you're eating them.
Yeah.
You know, whether and that's the thing, we kind of flip the words, like use musical terms to describe the food, use culinary terms to describe the music, you know, taste the music, hear the food.
We talk about dishes being harmonious.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And it's just like when you have one of those dishes and you take a bite of all of the things together, the starch, the vegetable, you know, the protein, and then you're like, what just happened? Like, I just changed because mm-hmm. this was amazing. And you're like, yeah, it was a bologna sandwich. But it was a bologna sandwich in such a way that, like, your mind is forever transformed and you can't go back to all those previous bologna sandwiches because you just had this one.
Right.
And
right.
part of the reason why it was delicious is it happened to be Don Henley singing. I'm not saying that Don Henley is bologna, but
you know, but pairing Don Henley with bologna,
but and that's just something that we try to do. My girlfriend works at the Tulane Goldring Center for Culinary Medicine, and they do celebrity chef dinners there. And Alex did the first one this year.
We're talking about Alex Harrell, who's the owner of Angeline, executive chef owner here. Yep,
my boss,
your boss. We haven't touched on that yet, so I just want to make sure people know who we're talking about.
Well, he was one of the chefs tapped for the dinner, and we have been pairing. We paired all the dishes with songs, so each course had a region of songs, like three or four songs, and there was. And then we wrote out the menu, sort of like liner notes and an album jacket. Side one is this, side two is that. This is why we picked them. Whether it was, you know, it was a French-inspired song because charcuterie is a French. Yeah. Idea, but the charcuterie journeyed from France through Dothan, Alabama, stopped in Muscle Shoals, and made its way to New Orleans because that's the path that Alex took.
There's a sweet road map right there for tunes.
Yeah, so, yeah. Oh, well, we're going to pick up this, and we're going to, so, you know, we're pairing it with Arthur Alexander, who was the first hit for Fame Studios with charcuterie, but it's his interpretation of charcuterie, so it's not straight up French-style charcuterie, it's his southern interpretation of it. You know, and there's a lot more seafood in it and a lot more vegetables, and because that's the times are changing.
Yeah.
You know, and then he plays guitar on his own. He's a guitar hobbyist. Well, that just, you know, so I'm naturally going to find songs that have a guitar, like, forward piece to it that I feel like go with these kind of flavors because that's part of his personality, and that's exactly what these dishes are. It's a cheeseburger, but it's his personality infused into that cheeseburger. That's why you come here for that cheeseburger.
Right.
You don't come here for a McDonald's cheeseburger. You come here for an Angeline cheeseburger because that's Alex interpreting it.
And that's neat, man. And there's a personality behind it. And so whether people are actually told that story or not, there's a backdrop or an atmosphere that's being painted then for the cheeseburger that you're enjoying.
Yeah, and the songs are a part of it. So... And we have, like, all this cool technology. We have Spotify, Pandora, we have Sonos. We have all these ways to listen to it. And the internet has supposedly free music. So now you have 10, 20 trillion songs to choose from, plus all their remixes.
Right.
So once again, I think that's a challenge for people, is, like, it's too much. So someone's got to go looking through it all.
And distill that down. Yep. Yeah.
And, you know... Just like a sauce, you reduce it down to the essence, the good stuff, and that's what goes into your sauce. So we'll filter out some of the music and just get the good songs that we think are, you know, worth it. And and then that changes with the mood. It changes with the service period, what we're serving. Brunch is going to be different than dinner. The sun has a huge influence. Like some songs sound better at night than they do in the daytime.
Yeah.
And so we're going to do that. We want to tie in with the community. So, like, when the Cigar Box Guitar Festival happened, our playlist was only Cigar Box guitar people or people we thought would play Cigar Boss guitars.
If it fit their vibe.
Yeah, so there was some Taj Mahal, and there was some Robert Johnson, okay. It's kind of going back to referencing the time period and the historical time period, the geographical time period. And then there was plenty of those groups that were playing over there. So even if you didn't go, you got a taste of what was happening in the city through our food and drinks and songs. And we're slowly educating the staff, so they're learning about it because they're the messengers. They're the town criers.
Yep.
I mean, they only go to a table. You know, they're not walking the streets, but it's still there. If they don't say the message, how is anyone going to know that there is a message?
Let's do this, man. Let's take a quick break, come back, talk a little bit more.
Sure.
All right, man. Friends, we're chatting with Murph Reeves here at Angelion Restaurant. We'll take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show. Come on back.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
The French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Now, Murph, one of the things that we did not do, that was the shortest break that we've taken. Here.
Yeah, it was.
That was about like 10 seconds. So. Now, for you listening wherever, that was probably about a minute and a half, but it's about 10 seconds. And we're talking about creating that atmosphere, creating that room, creating that space. And the aesthetic to be able to do that anywhere is, of course, possible. And you can tell an infinite number of stories putting these different variables together of food and drink and decorum and all of this. Not decorum, decor, excuse me. In New Orleans, we have a huge wealth to draw from in all of these things. And music is right at the top of that list.
Yeah, I mean, I call New Orleans a city full of professional socializers.
Right.
And socializing comes in all kinds of forms, but from birth to death in this city, like, there's a reason to throw a party. I mean, we have second lines.
Yep.
Like, we have sanctioned parades, the walking parades that stop city life so we can have a dance party in the street, a mobile dance party
right.
that goes on for hours.
Mm-hmm. And we had the unsanctioned ones that we kind of don't get in too much trouble for either.
No, it's easier to get a permit for a parade than it is for parking.
Yeah, right, there you go.
But that's why the service industry is so vibrant here, is because this is the stage for all that. This is the bars and the restaurants and the clubs are where you go to shine. This is where service is. It's a lifestyle. I mean, it's a lifestyle in all the cities, but I mean, you come down here, what do? We go out to eat, and all we do is talk about where we're going to eat next and the music we're going to listen to while we're eating. And
yep.
from eating point A to eating point B, there's drinks and we're walking with them in our hands, and there's bands on the street, there's marching bands, there's brass bands, there's, and then all the doors are open and there's bands playing in the clubs.
Yep.
And then you go into a lot of the businesses and they're playing WWOZ or they're playing WTOL, like they're playing the local music because it's that good and it's that important. And people don't really know how to exist without it.
You know, man, that's great. And one of the things I always like to say on the show when we do, because obviously this show is about, in theory, drink and food. But you know, we talk music a lot. I have musicians on the show and other things. I always say it's a tapestry. People probably are sick of hearing me say this. It is a tapestry. You cannot separate the threads of food, music, art, architecture, the vibe, like you're talking about, just walking down the street, maybe seeing your neighbor or seeing somebody you just met last night. If you're here visiting at a bar, sitting at another bar, those things are all part of a tapestry. You cannot pull one thread and separate them. They're all related.
Yeah. Tapestry. I use a quilt.
Quilt, perfect. Yeah.
But yeah, they're all intertwined. Like my four favorite things are food, drinks, music, and people. And I just shuffle them like a deck of cards. And what kind of combinations can come out of there? Whether it's like an event like Jazz in Geneva, where we paired songs with drinks and then had a band play those songs while you were drinking the drink, or our playlist is going on with an event here in the city, and our food, or some of the food and some of the drinks, are going to be geared towards that. Or just, we think this is really good. You should go listen to this. Like, there's nothing, we have nothing to do with it.
Yeah, go check out this
place.
But
you should go check this out.
Yeah, no
doubt.
Right.
Like, for instance, my next playlist is going to be Wood Brothers Heavy.
They're awesome.
They just put out a new record.
Oh, did they? Okay.
I saw them live, and what they did on stage is what I feel like a good restaurant does when they're jamming. Like, they brought different elements of music, history, Americana, playing styles, technology on the stage at different points, and let us peek into what they have and shared it with us. And it's just kind of when you come here to a restaurant, like we're letting you peek into what we think is awesome,
mm-hmm.
you know. And here it is. It's this dish or this drink, and most likely we're not even letting you peek in. Like, we're gonna open the curtain. You can just come on in.
Yeah.
Like, we're not keeping it a secret.
Here's what we do.
You know, most of these drinks that I made were invented over 100 years ago. I just, you know, update them with a few things and mostly a catchy name. But a lot of the guys already laid the groundwork. You know, it's just like the blues. Like, it's the same three chords. You know, Jerry Thomas is the John Lee Hooker of drinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and, and now we're just the Stevie Ray Vaughans today. We've run with what Jerry Thomas has had, but we've also... We can incorporate music and incorporate light and
right.
fashion and art and architecture and
respect those things where they came from.
Yeah. Right?
I think one of the things that we know here, I think one of the things that we see here, whether it relates, I mean, it relates to music, it relates to food, it relates to drink, is you kind of have to know the rules to break them. And I hate using that cliched expression, but there is a respect for the past here. And one of the things I always sometimes cringe about, Murph, is when I go to someplace else and they'll say, well, this is our riff on a Sazerac. Now, maybe it ends up being a good drink, but lots of times my thinking is, do you know how to make a Sazerac? Then you can riff on it, man. And it's like music. You can come in, and if you don't know the context in which you sit, then I'm going to argue 99% of the time you're doomed to fail.
Yeah. I think the first step in learning anything is listening
yeah.
and not talking, being silent, and just watching and listening. Watch what they do, how they do it, because you learn how to do good things, and you learn what not to do. And same with them playing music. You know, you watch a good musician, you watch how they do it. It's, you know, making a drink, everyone shakes it, but they all shake it a slightly different way. You know, like they all, like for me, when I'm shaking ice, like I'm listening for the ice to break. There's a certain sound that it gets to that I know that it's done. And I'm also like, when I'm in a good mood, like there's rhythms to what I'm shaking, and like you can hear it. Like I even like get into it, and like when my shake is finished, it's a little more upbeat than when I started it.
Right.
But it's just, I don't know. It also, to me, that's the irrational, the love, the passion that I'm going into it, because it's a Moscow Mule. So so it's right. But I want this to be the dopest one. And this guy who ordered it, this person who ordered it, has probably had one of these before,
mm-hmm,
in a different place, and they made it different. So this is my version of House of the Rising Sun, or you know, this, yeah, except it's a Moscow Mule, and I hope you like it.
And people see that presentation, they see the smile on the face, and I think, and we know this too, that, you know, whatever you want to call it, a sixth sense, anything along those lines, that plays into the vibe. That's the zeitgeist. That's the thing that goes on that people take away from all of this, right?
Well, yeah. You got three bars in a line. They all sell Budweiser, but you go to the one in the middle. Why do you go to the one in the middle? It's not the Budweiser, because they all have it. And Budweiser prides itself on it tasting the same no matter where you're drinking in the world. So why do you go into the middle bar?
Mm-hmm.
It's how the Budweiser is given to you, the light, the way it smells, the decor, the fact that they have every Waylon Jennings CD on the jukebox.
Yeah, person sitting next to you at the bar, no doubt.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Or the way they are, you know, like we talk about, you know, some of the personalities here in the city and how they're very specific, and you grow to need that personality. You know, we talk, you know, Paul Gustings, we talk about, and he's like an iconic figure here, but he does things a very specific way, and you're only going to get it by going to see him. Like you can't, it can't be reproduced, mm-hmm, by anybody else. They can learn from him,
mm-hmm,
but there's only one Paul Gustings,
right?
You know,
right.
And then if you go to that same bar when Paul's not there, there's kind of a hole,
yeah,
because his personality is like, it's like spiderwebbed into the corners of the rooms and the dusty bottles and that weird shaker tin that only he uses, but somehow it imparts his personal magic on everything. And that's what I think, you know, when the bartenders get it, is like when they tap into themselves and, you know.
It's, and then they fill that space when, yeah, Paul's not there.
Uh-huh.
That's a great point.
And that's what we're all trying to do, you know,
yep,
fill up the space with non-tactile awesomeness.
Yeah, I like that. Non-tactile awesomeness. Yeah. That's great. We'll call that NTA.
But I mean, like I said, like it's not the Budweiser.
Yeah.
It's everything else around the Budweiser.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe it's the smell, and that smell is dust and seafood and regret.
This is and regret. Who knows? Sorrow. Yeah. Everything, man. Yeah. Happiness, joy, everything in between.
I mean,
life,
the bar is like everyone, you know, touches the bar, and they touch it when they're in an emotional state, whether they're happy or sad. People go to bars kind of in extremes. You know, I'm celebrating or I'm miserating, or, you know,
right.
And then all the things in between. But that stuff lingers, and over time, like you can walk into a place that's been around for a long time, and you can feel it. You can feel it in the wood. You can feel it in the chairs. You can feel the way the edges are worn, that a lot of butts have been in that seat, mm-hmm, and a lot of stories and emotions have come across the bar and have stayed like a spirit.
Yeah.
Like you leave like a piece of your soul there as you build new pieces of your soul, like skin. And, you know, a big part of that is the staff, the bartender, the cook, the server, you know?
Yep. And the room, everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt, man. Well, Murph, do me a favor, man. Well, you and I are going to be doing something pretty cool, as we're going to work on a project with our buddy Mark Stone that we were talking about, tapping into playing some music from this part of the world that references food and drink, and this part of the world is not short on music that references food and drink. So we're going to do a lot more with you, man. But we got just a couple minutes left before we got to call it. Tell people where they can come find you at Angeline.
Angeline's at 1032 Charter Street. I'm here Wednesdays, Fridays, Sundays, and then the spaces in between. It's a magic place, and like it's kind of a force of nature, and I'm really lucky to be working with the chef and like the general manager, Adrian, and the whole staff here. It's just rad.
That's awesome. And it's a great place, friends. If you have not been here, if you're coming to visit, come see Angeline. If you live here and you haven't been here yet, well, we're about 3 years now.
Yeah,
I think.
Three years in March.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, Alex Harrell is a good friend of both of ours, and he's a fantastic chef and a super talented guy and a good human being. Great food, great place. Come check it out. When can people catch you on OZ again, man?
I'm on WWOZ every Monday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Central Standard Time. That's wwoz.org. or WWOZ 90.7 FM.
Louisiana Music Show, man. Awesome. And watch out for those Murph Reeves curated playlists that are going to be coming out. They're going to be coming to a restaurant near you, but you won't know, and that's how you know it's going to work.
Yeah, exactly.
Right on, bro. It's good to see you, man.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Friends, we're going to be back to close up the show. We'll take a little break here on the Noah Drink Show. Come on back.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bajot heads up the Small Plates and Charcuterie Kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
I'm gonna take you out, girl, and spend some time.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Hope you enjoyed that interview with my buddy Murph Reeves. Go check him out there at Angeline on Charter Street and our good buddy Chef Alex Harrell, as we were saying. Actually had brunch there. We recorded that, as we mentioned before Mardi Gras, for logistical and survival reasons. But we just went on Lundi Gras this past Monday. Alex put on a fantastic brunch. He's done this now 2 years in a row. It's called the Redneck Brunch, and it was a lot of fun. So, you know, things like fish sticks were served, but not the frozen kind that you buy in the grocery store. So a lot of these things were elevated versions of your redneck favorites. Like fish sticks, which I had, were great. A manwich, which just was made of awesome pulled pork. Murph was there behind the bar slinging drinks, wearing a purple jumpsuit. So, yeah, we had tequila sunrise shots, Alabama slammers, sex on the beach, a lot of classic stuff like that. I hate to use that term. We just talked about all these apothecary cocktails, part of the history of cocktails, and I'm calling sex on the beach and tequila sunrises classic cocktails. Go figure. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. Do go check out Angela. Murph's an interesting guy, and we're actually thinking to be working on a project together with another buddy of mine, Mark Stone, also a DJ on OZ and a local musician who was my featured interview 2 weeks ago, I guess, or so. And those guys, as we know, are both a wealth of knowledge as it comes to music. So we're going to start working on a project where we're going to get together and play little segments of songs, mostly New Orleans music that references food and drink, and talk about that stuff. It's a ways off in coming together, but we've been talking about it, have that concept in our back pocket, and I'd be excited to work with those guys on that. So check that out. Friends, I want to circle back on a couple of things that we were talking about at the beginning of the show. Bitters. We talked about Peychaud's. We talked about Angostura. Touched on Fee Brothers a little bit. Kind of the one that held on beyond Peychaud's and Angostura that were commonly used more than just about anything else besides those two were orange bitters. There were lots of different brands out there of orange bitters. Lots of different brands now out there of orange bitters. But what we've seen is an explosion again of bitters. As we were talking about before, there at the apothecary, everybody was making their own bitters. People were making them at home. Now we see this explosion of companies that are making bitters. And in many cases, they're still not, in many locations, not regulated as alcohol. So you can find them in any number of places besides liquor stores and groceries and bars.
we've seen a lot. Some people are even arguing that there are now too many bidders on the market. I don't know. I don't know if that's true. If the market will make that decision, I suppose. But, you know, we have Peugeots around again because of the Sazerac company are still around. Angostura Bitters is still around. Fee Brothers has made that comeback like we talked about. They've survived, hung on by a thread. Didn't talk about it too much, but they're still around. Then we have the Bitter Truth, Bitter Sling. We have El Guapo Bitters here in New Orleans, a fairly new company, doing all kinds of creative and interesting things. Now, there are tons and tons out there, and it's interesting. Make a drink. Make a classic Manhattan. Don't put bitters in it. Calls for Angostura. Don't put bitters in it. And try one with and try one without and see the difference. Bitters are sort of like the salt and pepper, if you will, of cocktails. And I think that's a good way to put it. Now, with this explosion of all these different types of bitters out there, different flavors, interesting blends, El Guapo comes to mind locally here, making all kinds of, you know, crawfish boil bitters and really interesting flavors. You have other companies making sriracha bitters, almost any kind of citrus-based bitters that you can possibly imagine. You can make bitters at home. That book that I mentioned, Bitters, by Brad Thomas Parsons, has lots of recipes and ideas for making bitters. But point is, they're all over the place in the market. They're pretty easy to find because they're not regulated like hard alcohol. And here, even in Louisiana, or just about anywhere that you are, at least in the United States, you can buy these things online. Get on Amazon. They got a ton. So check it out and play with that kind of stuff. Mix some in, just like I said, in soda water as a restorative. But different combinations can add a little bit of a different twist to a drink. They really do highlight drinks. And that's why cocktail bitters, like we're talking about specifically here, of course, is we're talking about they're measured in dashes. Some people think that it's going to make things, because if you just drink or have a little bit on the back of your hand by themselves, it's going to be really, really bitter. But when it's just added as an accent to a drink, and often these things are bitter, but they also have elements of sweetness, herbal elements, different flavors in them, they're enhancement. As I said, they're like salt and pepper for cocktails, and there are a lot of fun combinations to play with out there. Now, with the explosion of a lot of these bitters out there, some of them can be kind of tough to play with. I've been given some by different people at different times, and I'm not a mixologist. I'm not a bartender by any stretch of the imagination, but I like to play around at home. I think I have a pretty good sense of flavor, and I'm going, wow, I don't even have any idea what I can put that in. But just a few drops of bitters in a basic martini. Maybe change that combination. Try grapefruit bitters. Try rhubarb bitters in just a regular everyday old martini and see what you think. It really does form the basis of, or I don't want to say the basis, of course, but the key accent to so many cocktails that we enjoyed. And we're really starting to see, you know, for something that almost disappeared or was a dusty bottle on a bar shelf, primarily Angostura bitters or maybe Peugeot's bitters, with a lot of the drinks that we were drinking, you know, prior to the early 2000s, it was a forgotten element. And that's what we're talking about, you know, just joking about making, say, Sex on the Beaches or Alabama Slammers. We're talking about sweet fruit juice and hard alcohol, and that's pretty much it. And we almost lost touch with that key element of bitters and what they are. I know a lot of my friends who work in the industry, and I'll see them the next day after maybe a hard night, and they're doing exactly what I talked about. A little bit of bubbly water and four dashes of Angostura bitters or Peugeots might help turn your day around a little bit. So go check out that world that's out there. You decide for yourself if you think there are too many. Friends, we're going to have a good show coming up for you next week. Some of it's still in the planning stages, but one guest that I know I'm going to have is our good friend Pepper Bowen, who is the director of the Culinaria program, is going to be joining us again. She was on about a month ago. And one of the things that we're going to talk about, because of course here in the month of February, we're celebrating Black History Month, and we're going to talk about the Freedom Kitchens in New Orleans and some of the role that food played in the civil rights movement. And she's just a wealth of knowledge. She's one of those people, kind of like Murph or something, who I just had on, where we'll probably wend our way through many different topics. That's one that I know we've put on the books that we're going to touch on, but we don't even know exactly where the conversation is going to go, and that'll be half the fun. So I look forward to having her on. She's based there at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, which is located on Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. I believe it's actually, from what I've been told, we all say Aretha Castle Haley, but I guess it's Aretha Castle Haley. So there you go. That'll be a lot of fun to talk to her. And we'll have maybe some surprises in store for you next week, too, if all comes to pass as I plan. Oftentimes doesn't. We'll see what happens. Don't want to set myself up for failure. One other quick little note that I wanted to mention, too, harkening back to the very beginning, a little fun fact that I'll share with you here before we close out the show, is that there's still a weird term that's regulated in the United States, apothecary. We don't really use that term anymore, of course, to refer to pharmacies or anything like that. And our good friends there, Neil Bodenheimer and others that run Cure, the sort of original craft cocktail, or original new wave, I'll say, of craft cocktail bars in the
part of the cocktail renaissance in New Orleans, let's put it that way. When they first tried to open in, what was that, 2008, 2009, they wanted to call themselves Apothecary, and because of regulation, they were not allowed to do so. So hence why the bar there on Ferret Street is called Cure. Probably need to change some of these laws, but hey, I like the name Cure, but hey, Apothecary would have been a cool name too. Just like the stuff we talked about today. At least I hope you thought it was cool. Friends, I hope everyone has a great weekend. Hope everybody had a great Mardi Gras, is recovering from Mardi Gras. And one last thing that I want to say is, you know, everyone's thoughts and prayers are all really nice, and I know that it comes from a good place, but ultimately in my mind, it's kind of self-serving. I think it's probably time for a little bit of action. Whatever your beliefs are, too much tragedy. There are solutions to the problem. We need to start making some hard choices and addressing some of these things. So, friends, maybe just something to think about here. I hope everyone, again, has a great weekend. Be kind to one another. As always, use your turn signal. Happy post-Mardi Gras. And until then, cheers, y'all.